Well, it may seem like winter isn't the best time to talk about gardening, but actually, I think maybe we need it most this time of year just to help get through our Wisconsin winter. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Really pleased to have back Melinda Myers, a Milwaukee-based garden expert and the author of more than 20 books, including the brand new Minnesota and Wisconsin month-by-month gardening. She's also host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and we love it when she joins us. Melinda, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, always a pleasure here, too, as I'm looking out at the snow like everyone else here in Wisconsin. You're right. It's great to talk gardening and think about spring ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, here we are, Valentine's Day, really right around the corner, and I think it's a nice time to give anyone you value and appreciate a little something, and I'm betting you'd say that plants are a good choice.
Oh, always. Cut flowers, plants, even gardeners love to get cut flowers. You know, somebody once said to me, well, do you really like to get flowers and plants? I'm like, oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. It's always a good choice. And there are fun things you can do. If you've got youngsters or you want, you know, maybe somebody's on a diet and so they don't want chocolate, how about growing a small container of colorful leaf lettuce? You know, there's some wonderful leaf lettuce out there. You can get it started indoors. They can grow it in a sunny window, and they can keep harvesting as soon as the leaves are 4 inches tall, and it's a great way to give a lasting gift. Or, excuse me, if it's a gardener, maybe give them all the makings, a nice little container or tin that's got a Valentine theme, little potting mix, some seeds, and let them do it themselves. And then, of course, cut flowers and plants. Anthuriums have that beautiful heart-shaped red flower, long-lasting. It's beautiful. It looks very tropical, which it is, but it's easy to care for. I've had one last several months in bloom, take a little bit of neglect. Of course, I'm stress testing, not ignoring my plans. And does quite well. And cyclamens are another favorite with those flowers that look like shooting stars and the heart-shaped leaves that can be solid green or have a little silver variegation. Likes it cool, long-lasting bloom. And some of us, myself included, have been able to get it to rebloom, or you just add it to the compost pile, take the stress away, and put it in the garden in a different form once it's done blooming.
There you go. What about if, you know, if you've got somebody who is a black thumb instead of a green one, and the foolproof, what's the foolproof plant?
You know, there's a couple of them. ZZ plant is a wonderful plant. You see it growing in malls and airports. It's got long arching stems. It's got small leaves. They're really leaf petioles, so it's one big leaf coming from the base. They'll take neglect, they take low light, and they're wonderful, just avoid drafts. And then snake plants, or mother-in-law's tongues, kind of gives mother-in-laws a bad rap, but there's some new varieties available, and so it's a fun way to really spark things up, you know, with something shorter, different kinds of variegation. And then you can give them that Valentine's Day theme with maybe a cut flower and a florist pick and stick that in with that tropical plant so they have that beautiful bloom short-term and a plant long-term. And then philodendron and pothos, really long-term favorites, hardy, tough plants. And there's lots of new varieties out on the market. Brazil with that thin line of variegation down the center of the heart-shaped leaf, or the lime-colored neon pothos. So lots of new varieties on old-time favorites that are really good, tough plants.
You know, and on Facebook, Phil sent us some photos, which are really nice photos, and of Lenten roses. He recommends Lenten roses for a Valentine's Day gift, and a couple of nice photos on our Facebook page over on the left side, the left column under posts.
Okay, thank you. You can tell I'm like cruising through trying to look. And Lenten roses are great. They've come out as a popular plant for the Christmas holiday. The challenge for us is keeping them alive through spring. But Valentine's Day is a great option because one of the nice things is you don't have that long before they can go outside in the garden. So great idea, Phil. Thank you for that suggestion because, you know, it's the gift that can give not only immediately but also for seasons to come.
And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, Melinda Myers, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. Facebook page, and you can post your questions or your comments there. We'd certainly love to hear from you. We had a question from Brooke, who wonders or who asked, it looks like Madison closed down its compost sites. I plan to expand our raised bed gardens. Does Melinda have any ideas on alternative sites to get good quality compost? Organic is for her is not required to fill out her beds this spring.
Right. You may want to contact the Extension office. Honestly, in the Madison area, I'm not quite sure who would have those products available. Many garden centers are now providing compost. I've had good luck with mushroom compost. So if you know of a mushroom farm in the area, you know, it's horse manure and straw, and it's been composted. There's been some concerns raised about the salt levels. I personally haven't had problems, but, you know, it's always a good idea to test it out and check it with the supplier. Many of the topsoil companies are also providing compost or mixed blends. One of the things I like to do with raised gardens is get a planting mix, you know, from a quality topsoil company. And what that has is lots of compost in it, and it's got a blend of some topsoil, so it holds the moisture a little bit better, but also organic matter. And there are good topsoil providers, and there are some not so good, just like in any company, in any business. So check with your friends that do a lot of gardening and ask around if they've had some good success with anyone in particular. Buying bags of compost is great for small-space gardeners or if you don't have a place to store a truckload. But if you're doing a lot of raised beds, I would take a look in the yellow pages, call the Extension Service and ask some of your other gardening buddies. And attend the expo this weekend in Madison. It's a great chance to get a bit of a gardening fix, a little aromatherapy. And there are a lot of suppliers from around the state, but particularly Madison, that may be able to help as well.
Mm-hmm. And good advice there. Dan in Fond du Lac has a question for you. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just love garden talk. My wife wants to graze some flowers to make cut flower bouquets, and we don't know what kind of flowers to, seeds to buy and when to start them. We could start them in pots in the basement.
You know, pardon me, I did a talk on cut flowers, and somebody at the audience said, well, what I learned from you, Melinda, is about anything can be used for cut flowers. So the good news is there are a lot of plants that work very well. Now, starting the seeds depends on the flowers that you're growing. So her first thing should be, what does she like to use? She may want some perennials to have a, you know, year-to-year supply. Astilbes are great. Even hostas, the leaves and the flowers, work very well. I'm always amazed when I go through my garden and I need a quick bouquet and I'll pick some things to find plants I maybe overlooked that really work well. In terms of annuals, I love Lysianthus or Eustoma. It's a little tricky to start from seed and hard to find plants, and it's a long time that you're going to need to start it pretty quick. Prairie Gentian is another common name for it. Last 10 days in the vase. It's a beautiful plant. Bachelor's Buttons are another one. Centaurus, some of that group, is also a very good choice. The annual Larkspur. What I would recommend she do is go through the catalogs. If you want to start things from seeds, finding plants and flowers that she likes, and then you'll find the information in the catalog or on the seed packet when to start. I know I'm kind of leaving you out there, but there's such a long list. In fact, I'd be happy to, if you email me at info@melindamyers.com, I will send you my list from my talk I did a few years ago of the flowers that you'll probably find growing in your garden already, and then some that you can add as well. You know, marigolds work well. They do have that kind of smell. Zinnias are excellent. So the list is pretty long, so not trying to avoid the question, but I think have her go through the catalog, start picking out what she likes, and then start looking at when they need to be started. A friend of mine gave me a great idea about doing a seed starting calendar. So, you know, you get all these seed packets and they come to your house and you get excited and then you kind of miss the date to start one. And his suggestion was get out the calendar, create one. Okay, you look at the seed packet. This needs to be started 8 weeks before the last spring frost. This one 6 weeks. This one 4 weeks. And then you write it down so that reminds you when to start them. So I'm hoping this gives her a little bit of an idea of wide variety of plants to choose from. If you have sun, your options are great. Shade, there are still some things you can grow. So I'm happy to send you that. Just send info@melindamyers.com, say cut flowers, and we'll send you out that handout, which gives you a good detailed list on flowers you can grow and things that you may already have in the garden.
There you go, Dan.
Well, great. In other words, anything goes. Huh?
Well, that's my philosophy. And as I find gardeners, I'll look at bouquets and I'm like, I never thought of picking that. You know, hydrangea flowers, roses. It's not just the common plants we think about. So she's got lots of opportunities.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dan, for calling. Stacy in Nina, it is your turn. Hi, Stacy.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have never forced bulk before, so I'm giving that a shot, and I don't know if I messed it up or not. But I had a bunch left over, so I thought I would try it. What I did was I put them all in, like, a plastic bag, and then I insulated them real well. I put them in a cardboard box, and then I insulated them with a bunch of newspaper, and I set them just outside. So I didn't put them in the basement because I didn't think the basement was going to be cold enough. Did I already kill them?
Well, it would just be here's the problem. We've had such cold temperatures that the cardboard and newspaper may not have been enough insulation. When we put the bulbs in the ground, that soil insulates them and keeps those temperatures, you know, at freezing or slightly above. You know what? We always learn from our mistakes, at least I do, more than my successes. So how's that for spinning it positively?
They were left over, so I thought I would try it.
And you know what? They work great in the compost pile, too. here's the deal, though. You know, I'm guessing they probably, once they warm up, they'll turn to mush because of the extreme temperature. If they're nice and firm, after they thaw out, they need 12 weeks. 12 to 15 is even better. 15 weeks of temperatures between 35 and 45. You're right. The basement's usually not cold enough. A garage, if you pack them in peat moss or plant them and then surround that pot with insulation material, pot them up, sink them in the soil if it isn't already frozen, which I'm guessing is probably what happened, does to me.
Yeah.
One gardener had a great solution. He had a prefabbed pool, and he'd empty the water in the fall. He'd pot up his bulbs, set them in that pond so they're below ground, pack it full of straw, throw a piece of plywood over top. After 15 weeks, he'd take a pot out, recover it, take a pot out the next week, and he had great success because the surrounding soil provided the insulation. I know now I tell you, right?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, like you said, live and learn.
That's right. And so next year, put that on your list of fun things to try because it is really exciting to make that happen.
Yeah, I was. Okay. All right. Well,
okay. You bet. Thanks, Stacy.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at the garden today, we're talking Valentine flowers and plants and a whole lot more with our guest for today, Melinda Myers, author of a lot of books, a lot of gardening books, including she got a brand new one here now. It's Minnesota and Wisconsin Month by Month Gardening. And, of course, she also hosts Melinda's Garden Moments. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson joins us. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and she always has great advice to share. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, visiting with Milwaukee-based garden guru Melinda Myers, and you can join in. Questions for her? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Bruce in Algoma up next. Bruce, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I always pass these municipal mulch piles with a significant degree of envy, thinking, wow, wouldn't that be nice in my backyard? Is there any circumstance where your experts would feel you could use that pile? Could you age it? I realize there could be pesticides in there and some other things you don't want, but how would you recommend dealing with that?
All right.
So you're talking compost, not wood chips, but the compost, correct?
Leaves or whatever.
Correct.
Yeah. That's a really good question. Back in the 80s, when a lot of municipal composting was just starting, the University of Minnesota did a lot of testing, and they found that once it was composted, they were not finding the pesticide residue. You're right. You're not sure if somebody's taking grass clippings from a treated lawn or anything like that. But if it's an actively composted facility where they're turning, it's breaking down, or it's 3 years in the process, so it's really well broken down, really they're not finding the residue of pesticides. One of the things you could do is take a sample and test it, grow a tomato seedling in there. Tomatoes are very sensitive to pesticides, and it's a great way to check and see if there is a problem. I've used compost when I ran the community garden program in Milwaukee in my own garden as well. If it's not fully broken down, then if you've got space, continue that process, turning occasionally, maybe adding some fresh material or a little bit of fertilizer, keeping it moist like the consistency of a damp sponge. Get it broken down so it looks just like finished compost, not like leaf pieces and things, you know, that you can still see the base.
Sure.
And you should be fine. That's pretty much what I found from the research that's out there, that, you know, if it's broken down, you're in good shape.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce, for calling. Appreciate it. Tater in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a follow-up question to one of the questions that you asked before.
Uh-huh.
Somebody had asked about when to plant, and you had said that on seed packets it says like 8 weeks before the last frost. My question is, how do you predict when the last frost is? Because that changes from year to year.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so it's usually the average last frost. So you're absolutely right. If you think about each spring, it varies greatly. So we're looking at an average. I mean, I see Milwaukee's average as early, in most cases, saying April 15th. But we all know, I've experienced early June frost when I was with the city and wiped out a lot of coleus in Milwaukee County. So what you kind of do is kind of look at when you typically are going to put your plants out in the ground, and the average frost dates, the weather department, you can just Google the average frost for your community. And so then what you have to do is then you look at the weather once that average frost date arrives and goes, is it safe to put them out? Do I need some added protection? Do I start the hardening off process? I tend to be a little more skeptical, so I tend to say, okay, well, that's what they say the average frost is. This is typically when I'm going to put the plants out. You know, cool weather things like pansies and lettuce, we're talking April, but some years we still have a lot of snow on the ground in April. So you may either adjust before, kind of given the long-range prediction, or plan accordingly and then just be prepared to protect them, put them in a cold frame, use row covers to kind of give them that break until the weather is frost-free.
And, you know, with vegetables like peppers, for example, here, you know, sitting in Madison, I don't plant them until the 1st of June. I've had too many times where it really doesn't take a frost even for some of those, something like,
you know. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, for something like green peppers.
Well, and you know, you bring up a good point, Larry. Some plants, like pansies, cilantro, will take a light frost, and they'll take cooler air and soil temperatures. Some plants, like beans and corn, won't take the frost, and if the soil's too cool, they don't germinate quickly, and you have problems with root maggot. So you want to make sure, that's why mid-May is usually time. Melon, pepper, tomatoes, as Larry mentioned, they not only don't tolerate a frost, they need warm soil and warm air. So if you have heavy clay soil, it's slow to warm up. So even though it's frost-free for a couple weeks, if it's been cool, those plants are going to sit there and struggle. So you also need to consider the soil temperature. Thanks for mentioning that, Larry. Mm-hmm. So I hate to make it sound complicated, but it's just kind of watching the weather, reading the packets. My month-by-month book gives some guidelines about when to put things in the ground, just as many gardening resources out there, especially from the Extension Service, do as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks again for calling, Tater. Appreciate it. And that month-by-month gardening is new and updated.
Right. It's been updated, and we've changed the format a little bit. So instead of lawns, January, February, March, April, you know, bulbs, January, February, March, April, it's January, kind of the things you plant, the things you plan, any pest problems, so that it becomes more of an easy access. So now it's January, and you can kind of flip through the different categories, see what you need to do or can do in your garden. So I'm very excited about that new format. And even though we've included Minnesota, you know, I realize Minnesota and southern Wisconsin are a little bit different, northern Minnesota. So I take that into account when I'm describing tasks you can do or things to see. And as Taylor mentioned, even in Wisconsin, you live in the same place, the season varies. So I talk a lot about climate, not just dates. So keeping your eye on the weather is really critical.
And, you know, I also wanted to mention this. You've got a brand new DVD set out. It's through Great Courses, isn't it? It's...
You bet. I've been lucky enough. This is our third one. It's Make the Most of Make Your Trees and Shrubs Thrive. So we were shooting this last year here in Wisconsin, most of it, and then the studio work in D.C. So January we watched the snow build and the 19 below. And so, yes, it was a tough year to get all the shooting in, but I'm excited because we did transplanting. We planted trees and shrubs, bare root, container, bald and burlap. We did some pruning, small scale. You know, you want to hire the professionals for the big things. We showed some pest things. We did some demonstration in the studio. So I'm very excited because it's a look at trees and shrubs. And if you go through my website to order it, it just is a link from my website to Great Courses. You'll get a huge discount. So you want to do that so you can take advantage of that discount they're offering to people who enter through my website. But I'm very excited because we were able to shoot it here in Wisconsin. It's a zone neutral. It's for their client bases around the world, but it covers a lot of things that gardeners are always asking us on this show and when I'm out speaking. So I'm very excited. And then in the spring, edibles is coming out, and I had the opportunity to follow my garden start to finish, and we did lasagna gardening, raised beds. We did harvesting techniques. I got to show some different things you could do in your garden and ways to maximize your harvest and have fun and make it easy.
Oh, man. I can't wait to see that one. That's going to be great.
Yeah. I'm very excited because I think so many of us are trying to grow more produce in less space or with less time or maybe more produce in more space, but some tips for everyone.
And we have a link on our Facebook page, too, at the Larry Mueller Show where to go for the discount if you're going to purchase that DVD on trees and shrubs. So that's another place to go. So you can also call in, by the way, if you have a question or comment. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And an email from Joanne in Winona, Minnesota. She says, a beautiful orchid was given to me for the holidays. It has just one flower remaining. What do I do now? Toss it out into my recycle bin or pamper it into reblooming for the next cycle?
You know, my orchid growing friends would say, oh, no, you can rebloom it easily. One of the fun things about orchids right now is they're much more affordable and more readily available than in the past. And so some gardeners are looking at it as a long-lasting living cut flower. You enjoy the blooms and compost it, or better yet, find someone who would like to grow that orchid. Really what you can do, very easy to grow, you want to keep the soil slightly moist. Don't overwater it because it is a organic mix of either bark and some peat moss. And so usually just, a little bit of water once a week, so you moisten that whole root zone, usually once a week unless your house is really hot, or a little bit less if it's cool. Leave that last flower fade. If it's a phalaenopsis, on the moth type of orchid, cut that flowering stem in half, and hopefully you'll get a second flush of bloom. Otherwise, you can remove that flower stem. As the days are lengthening, the bright light intensity is increasing, you could give it a little bit of fertilizer, any flowering plant fertilizer. You want to make sure it's actively growing, though. And that you can do, usually March is the time we start doing our fertilizing for most plants if they're not under artificial light. And then some people will move them out in a somewhat shaded location for the summer. Or if you don't move plants in and out for the summer, I just put it in a good bright window. I would give it a shot. Here's the deal. You can always add it to the compost pile later and not tell anyone. But in the meantime, give it a shot. I think you'll find out that you'll have much better success with very little effort. A lot of good sites on the internet so that you can find out more and maybe match your type of orchid if I haven't covered, you know, if it's not a Phalaenopsis or Cattleya, a little trickier, but that's one of them. You also remove the flower stem. So I think I'd give it a try if I was you. You may find out it's not that hard to do. It's that combination of benign neglect. Don't overdo the water. And good bright light, and you should have good success.
Absolutely. And the Wisconsin Orchid Society has a site.
Excellent.
A website that would be another place to go and look just to find some more information. So there you go. Thank you very much for that email question. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Is there a plant that you've gotten for a gift you really love, or maybe what did well in your garden last year? I'd like to hear about that experience, or what didn't do well. Love to hear about that, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. We had Chris had called and couldn't hang on, but lives near Baraboo and wonders where she can plant in her, when she can plant in her cold frame. And maybe describe, for those who aren't familiar with a cold frame, maybe you could describe that as well.
You bet. Cold frames are an old gardening technique. A lot of gardeners use old window sashes as a covering, and the idea is it's a low structure designed to capture the sunlight and hold that heat from the sunlight to keep things warm. Hot beds are just cold frames. Used to be made on manure piles, so you get the heat from the compost, usually on the south side of a building so that you've got it angled towards the most sunlight possible for both light for your plants and for heat. And then you vent it when the temperatures rise, and there are some systems that you can buy that are thermometers that will vent it if it gets too warm inside and close it, or you can manually do that. A thermometer is handy because it's always amazing to most gardeners how warm it gets inside those cold frames. I'm a low construction gardener, so I like to use floating row covers.
Yeah.
And those are fabrics that let air, light, and water through but trap the heat, and they protect plants down to 24 degrees. So obviously a little bit cold yet for that. So usually, typically what we can do with a cold frame or with floating row covers is back it up about a month. So we can start about a month earlier, again, depending on the weather, to get started. Many gardeners will seed leaf lettuce and greens, things that are cold weather tolerant, right in their cold frames, you know, in early April or mid-April, and, you know, are able to keep it warm that way with that cold frame. You know, again, kind of think about the normal planting time. Back it up. Start by backing it up by a month. And then I know you might be able to even squeeze out a little more time, but I'm always good at build success. You know, start 4 weeks, 6 weeks earlier than the normal planting range. UW Extension has a good sheet on, I think it's called the Cultivar and Planting Guide. And it's one of their publications, Vegetable Cultivar and Planting Guide. And it gives you how much produce you can get from a foot in the foot per foot row, when to plant inside and outside, and it talks about the differences throughout the state. I include a bit of that in my book as well, but this is online, free to download, and it would be a good resource for everybody who is thinking about doing vegetables indoors and or just outside.
Good points. Laura in Twin Lakes has a question. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have aphids hatching in my house in the plants that I had outside during the summer last year, and some of them are pretty big plants. I have Brugmansia. I have, another plant that I don't know what it is, and any suggestions would be helpful.
Yeah, that's always the challenge when we bring plants in from outside. Often there are some critters that hop along, spider mites and aphids being some of the more common, and sometimes whitefly. On a positive note, aphids and mites are a little bit easier to much easier to control than whitefly. Big plants, you may want to put a shower curtain or plastic tarp underneath and then just really spritz it down with water, and then hit it with insecticidal soap or a horticulture oil. Check the label to make sure the plants you're spraying won't be adversely affected. They do take control aphids on a wide variety of plants. If they're manageable, what I like to do is I'll take my big plants into the bathroom, put a garbage bag over the pot so the soil doesn't go down the drain, and then just put them under the shower so the water dislodges a lot of them. Then I come back and spray them with insecticidal soap or neem. So I've knocked a lot of them off with the water, then let them drip dry and put them back. Now, that depends on how big they are and easy it is to move them or if you have somebody willing to help you. But water first will dislodge many, then follow up with insecticidal soap or neem, N as in Nancy, E-E, M as in Mary, or horticulture oil. Especially if you have plants, using the insecticidal soap or the oils are a better option. I have cats that like to munch on the leaves, so yeah. I don't want to use anything that's going to hurt them.
Yeah.
I had been told by somebody to use preparation with imidacloprid.
Yeah, and that's very effective. That's a systemic. It's the same product that's used to treat emerald ash borer. It's used on flowers outside. There is concern on flowering plants outdoors where the bees that are pollinating our flowers can be harmed. But if you're treating now, this should not be a problem by the time you move them out. It's great. Again, if you have pets that eat plants or kids that like to munch on plants, I would go with something safer. But this is a systemic that is taken up by the roots, travels through, concentrates in the stem and in the leaves. So when the aphids feed, they'll die. So yeah, that is another option as well.
There you go, Laura. Okay. Thank you for calling very much. Jack and Marinette, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just thinking of your show, and it's a very good show, and I've been raising, I call it raising, my own seeds for the last about 10 years since I retired. And what I have is a simple system. I have a series of old storm windows that were the wooden frames. And I have this made so I can put it together on the south side of my house with the cover that raises up. And I start my plants in there and just water them by hand. I don't have a watering system or anything. And if it gets really cold, I use some light bulbs in there at night. Or if it's really cold, I just carry them into my garage. But and it works fine. It works very good. I haven't bought any plants, tomatoes, peppers, or anything for 5-6 years. And another thing is, there were a question that somebody had called in about how do you know when to start your plants. Well, for the last 10 years, I have a calendar that's in my, what I call my man cave, my garage, and I write down whenever the frost hits in our area, so each year I can go back on that calendar and take a look and see when the frost hits. And there's been a couple times that I've started my tomatoes too early, and by the time I put them out, you know, they're really spindly in that. So each year I write on there and just put on to down a few days or a week or something. But the system of this, I call it my hot box. I put this hot box up. It's all screwed together with L-irons. And when I'm done with it, I can just take it apart. And I just have three shelves in there. And it's nothing fancy. I use some seal coating pails that I put down on the bottom and some pressed wood for the first shelf. And then I have little 2x4s in that to make the other two shelves. And I have a thermometer in there, and I'll tell you, you have to watch it. Like you had mentioned, the amount of heat that the sun can bring through that glass, there's times that it'll hit 110 in there, and I have to open it up. I have little blocks that I set under, and also I leave an airspace on the bottom of it so it's not real tight, that some air can flow through the bottom of it. So I just thought it'd be...
Yeah, that's a great idea, isn't it, Melinda?
Definitely, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jack, but I wanted to just expand on your idea of a garden journal. Keeping notes about the weather and your planting is a great idea because, you know, every year, was that the variety I liked? When was that frost? You can find a lot of that on the Internet these days, but if you have it handy right where you do your work, that's an excellent idea. So a garden journal can be a spreadsheet on the computer if you like to work on the computer, notes on your phone if that's where you like to record information, or a spiral notebook. But you're absolutely right. Tracking information weather-wise as well as your gardening practices. And a lot of times, if you remember back in November when the temperature suddenly dropped, it was 9 degrees, Well, I'll remember the mild December, but I remember coming home. I was leading a tour to Costa Rica and coming home to 9 degrees. That was not happy. Containers and hoses frozen because I thought I had another week or two to clean things up. Luckily, it thawed out, and I did, but that sudden drop in temperature can cause damage just because of the drastic change. So recording significant weather events like that is also good because when we see problems on trees and shrubs the following year, it may be the cause was back to that sudden temperature drop.
Yeah. Yep. And my, Jack, that was great. Thank you so much. It sounds, if you can take a photo, I'd love to see. Sometime now, when you got that put together again this summer, I want you to shoot a photo and post it up on our Facebook page so we can see what that looks like. It really sounds great. Sounds like you've done a wonderful job. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Wow. Melinda Meyer is our guest today, Milwaukee-based gardening expert, author of 20 books, including the brand new Minnesota and Wisconsin Month-by-Month Gardening. And also, of course, she hosts Melinda's Garden Moments. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Melinda Myers, author of, among other things, Minnesota and Wisconsin Month-by-Month Gardening. And she hosts Melinda's Garden Moments. Always great to have her with us. And you can join in. Question or comment for her about your gardens. Maybe it's flowers. Maybe it's vegetables. Could be trees, shrubs. Call us at 800-642-1234. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. Todd in Minong up next with a question. Hi, Todd.
Yeah, good morning, you two. I think Jack was reading my notes. but I'm a real novice gardener, and I have a spot up on my garage where I'd like to put in a greenhouse. And I thought of laying some block and then framing over some, getting some plastic over a frame. And I'm wondering how early I can start putting plants in there. You know, it's pretty cold up here. But I have no idea of really when I could, what kind to put in and when I can start doing it.
You know, so is it going to be just solar heated, more of a cold frame like Jack described? When I think of a greenhouse, those are solar heated, meaning no external heat, some that have heating built in. Do you have an idea?
No, it would be totally external.
Okay. One of the things I would suggest is as soon as you can get in there to put it together, get a max min thermometer. And one of the things you can do is then take the temperatures, and it'll show maximum and minimum temperature and start recording that to see what your temperatures inside that cold frame are going to be. There was a couple from Minnesota, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember the name of their book, but they did passive solar greenhouse, and they were growing greens year-round, but they did have some supplemental. They had a storage system for the solar heat built into the ground, a reservoir, and they did $12, they said, worth of electric heat throughout the whole year and were able to grow greens year-round. They did some broccoli late into November and then starting it in February. And so, again, looking at your maximum temperatures, and then getting things, if you can start your seeds inside, that's going to give you a little bit better opportunity because a lot of our seeds need warm temperatures to germinate. So get it built, start taking the temperature, and then when your temperatures are staying in the 50s and 60s, you can start planting, and even in the 50s for some of the cool season crops, if you're going to garden right in there. So I think that would be your plan of action.
Yeah, pretty good plan.
Was the heat source just a light, simple light bulb, or was it something else?
They had a much larger greenhouse setting, so it wasn't a small.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't a small cold frame. They had electric heat in that, so they had some electric heat built in. You know, compost around your cold frame is another way to warm things up a bit. You know, creating your compost either underneath your cold frame or around. It sounds like you're putting a solid stone surface. But you could just put it right down on the soil, which actually wouldn't be a bad idea, or right on compost underneath, so you've got a warm source right underneath your flats.
You know,
it's only about 8 foot square.
About eight.
Very small.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's, I'm repeating myself here from another show, but I have a friend who had found an old boat hoist, and he took the sort of the guts out of it, that the part that raises the boat up and down, and then he had this wonderful frame that he made. That's what he made into his greenhouse.
Oh, excellent.
And he just had some heavy-duty materials, over
plastics
it.
Plastic
to cover it. And it's worked wonderfully. It really worked great. And you've got this great frame.
Yeah, sure.
And go ahead.
Metal frame. Just a metal frame from an old Menards garage type thing to store a boat in.
Perfect.
Cut that up.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, and so, yeah, exactly. And the bigger the area, above ground, so you might want to put where your thermometer near the ground where the plants are going to be and start monitoring. I know, it'd be great if I could give you a date, but as we've been talking, weather's crazy. Even your own yard, you probably see difference from the front to the back. And one of the things I love about gardeners as I travel around is, right, Larry, they have such great ideas and so inventive.
Absolutely.
Taking what's headed to the recycling center and making it into something useful. So great ideas from both of you.
There we go, Todd. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Barbara and Nina a chance to join us. Barbara, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a small problem. I have got a great compost pile. It's a wooden box, and I have got bees that have colonized in my compost pile. Two different types. One is definitely the fuzzy bumblebee. The other one, I think, maybe mason bees. They're very docile. They don't bother me. But the bumblebees are notorious attackers. And I don't really want to kill the bees because I know they're good, but I don't know how to get rid of them because I want to use my compost.
I can't. They're not there now.
Well, yeah, they were there last summer, and they wintered over in there, but they haven't been out yet in spring, and I don't know how to get rid of them before the weather breaks.
I don't think they overwintered, but...
I'm with you, Larry. I don't, mason bees usually overwinter in, and I'm kind of stepping into some foreign territory here, but usually overwinter in small holes, like straw-sized holes or reeds. So if you look at creating nesting sites for mason bees, and I think you're right, I don't think they're overwintering. Getting out there on a cool day to turn your pile would be the best way to see if anything survived. This might be a good Phil question, just to be sure.
Yeah.
Larry and I are right.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm pretty sure.
They do look. They look like a honeybee, but because they're so friendly, I mean, I worked around there and everything, and none of them attacked me. And there were lots of them, but bumblebees are pretty much what I couldn't tolerate. I mean, they came out and attacked.
Well, in the fall they would do that, but
they're both in the same compost pile, so. They found a little hole, and I know exactly where they go in. I even watered down compost pile to see if they had a back door where they were going to, exit, and that didn't deter them at all.
Mm. What I would suggest you do, get out early and turn or spread your compost. You can touch it gingerly if you're concerned, but Larry, I agree with Larry in terms of they're probably not there anymore.
They're gone.
And then turning your compost regularly will help discourage them from going back into your compost bin. I know that's more work on your part, but that might be a way to coexist a little better. So getting out there early on a cool day, that's a good time to, work up a sweat, get the compost where you need it in the garden. And then as you build your new pile, then just actively turning it, I think, will help discourage them from, a new group from moving in.
Yeah, I think
I wouldn't be destroying a hive that's, beneficial or anything.
No.
No, so I think you've let them live there. They have a summer home, time for it's time for you to put that compost in the garden.
Yeah, and those bees are probably, most of them are going to be looking elsewhere. If the, you know, the, you're not going to get the same ones back. I don't. I'm pretty sure of that. So I think you're safe, Barb. But if we're wrong, please call back and let me know. But I don't think I'm wrong. I don't think we're wrong on this one. Thank you again. Chris in Delafield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Hello. I probably got the dumbest question of all. I wanted to know if you can take, I brought my potted soil into the basement for the winter that I had my begonia bulbs in.
Uh-huh.
I cleaned it out really good, fluffed it up. Can you restart your bulbs in there before, you know, because I always pot them in the house, and get them started so they're really nice and full by the time summer starts? Can I repot them in there just to start them, or is that dumb?
So this is not a dumb question. I just, before you go, so this is fresh potting mix, or this is potting mix you used last summer and you want to reuse it?
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
The latter of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understood, Chris, and not a dumb question. I get this all the time, okay? Here's the downside of reusing potting mix. If you had any disease organisms or insects in there and you use it, whether it's to start your bulbs or, you know, your tuberous begonias inside, or it's to reuse your container and that potting mix outside, you take a chance that those disease organisms and insects are still there, and then they're right there waiting for your new plant so that they can attack it. I like to start with fresh potting mix every year. I know it's an expense. I put the old stuff in my compost bin, so I'm recycling it eventually into the garden. If you are reusing it, never reuse anything where you had a disease or insect-infected plant. Definitely don't reuse that. Keep an eye on it. But, you know, for starting indoors especially, I would get a fresh potting mix to get them started, because that's such a concentrated area. They're under stress with the lower light. And, you know, I think it'll be worth the investment. It sounds like you do a good job starting them indoors, and I think spending that extra money will help you have better results. And then if, you know,
okay.
Yeah, I know. You were hoping for a better answer, but sorry.
There it is. Oh, yeah, thank you, Chris. Elizabeth in Stillwater, Minnesota has something for us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. If she does have bumblebees in her compost pile, the queen bee overwinters, all the other bumblebees die.
I don't think she had bumblebees, but thank you for that.
Well, that's what she mentioned. And then she mentioned also mason bees. Mason bees live in holes, like you mentioned. So
right.
My guess is that she very well could have a honeybee swarm in there. She'd see that by opening it up and seeing comb. But European honeybees are quite docile. So, you know, it's not likely that they would be bothering her. And they do overwinter the whole colony. So she would, again, be destroying honeybees as well if she stirs the compost up.
Yeah, I don't think... You're going to find honeybees in that sort of a situation.
Yeah, they want to find a cavity.
Well, yeah, but there's not really a cavity.
In your compost pile.
In the pile itself, there's no cavity. I don't think I've ever heard of honeybees in something like that.
And I misunderstood. I thought she was saying not bumblebee. Well, you bring up a good point, Elizabeth. There's a lot of variety of bees out there. And nesting opportunities, so it might be worth her, you know, if she, you know, taking a look, but, and maybe calling back when Phil's on, and maybe if she can have a conversation with him and describe him a little more precisely, just to kind of get out your information, too.
If she or any listener is concerned about bees, there's lots and lots of beekeeping groups, and you can just Google Beekeeping Association of whatever state you're in, and you will likely find someone that can answer questions.
Yeah, for
well,
sure.
And also get swarms for you, too, many of them. I found when I was with Extension, we had a few that would come, and if there was a honeybee colony swarming, would come and help you out with it and take them away.
Yeah.
Good point.
And Phil and PJ, who is the new Insect Lab Director, they're going to be on, Judith reminded me, on the 17th of February. So Hang on, she probably shouldn't do anything anyway right now and just wait and ask that question again of Phil and PJ, but I'm pretty sure they're going to say it's probably not likely a honeybee swarm inside a compost pile.
Yeah, that would be my feeling. But Elizabeth, thank you for, it's always good to remind people that we need to embrace the bees in our landscapes and green spaces because they do such good things for us. So,
absolutely.
A good reminder, Elizabeth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Phil and Pete, excellent resource.
And Jim in Milwaukee, hi, thank you for calling.
The people who are addicted to tobacco, my understanding is a lot of Wisconsin soils can grow tobacco. Why not plant your own tobacco and harvest your winter crop around Halloween?
Tobacco used to be a big crop in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Still growing in the Edgerton area by a lot, actually. Yeah.
Okay, so it might be, or maybe find something to substitute that's healthy and nutritious. Break the habit. Easy for me to say.
But there are some tobacco, flowering tobacco plants that are really smell wonderful.
You bet. Flowering tobacco, fragrant in the evening. The hummingbirds and butterflies love them. In fact, one of my topics at the Garden Expo Valentine's Day is on gardening for birds and butterflies. And so I do talk about it because it's a wonderful plant. So a good chance to talk and see some pretty plants.
Yeah, and the flowering tobacco are, those plants are planted some, had some in a garden on my previous property, and they smell just absolutely wonderful. Well, we are have had a great time here and having a great time visiting with Melinda Myers. Melinda is a Milwaukee-based gardening expert, the author of more than 20 books, including the brand new Minnesota and Wisconsin Month by Month Gardening. Our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's easy to think about that patch of dirt in your yard as our garden, but actually, if we're lucky, we share that space with a whole variety of critters, and that means we are stewards to a whole vibrant ecosystem. So good advice for keeping it thriving, I think, is always a big help. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us for Friday's Garden Talk. Really pleased to have Melinda Myers with us, Milwaukee-based gardening expert and regular for many, many a year here, and author of more than 20 books, host of Melinda's Garden Moments. And really, Melinda, always great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's always great to be here.
Great to have you with us. And we have, you and I are going to be at Garden Expo. We each have presentations. Before we get into that, I want to give our listeners a chance at some free tickets. So our friends over at Wisconsin Public Television have given us 10 pairs of tickets.
Excellent.
Yeah, to next weekend's Garden Expo to give away. They're good for one day's admission. Your choice, you could either go Saturday or Sunday. And winners' names are going to be at the will call window. And, of course, we're going to let people know. I am going to give you 10 minutes to enter by sending an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Or you can phone 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Need your first and last names for the list and a phone number to call to let you know if you won. So that's and we're going to do a random drawing of all the entries at the end of 10 minutes. So Judah's fingers will be flying. Again, you have 10 minutes. What is it now? It's about 9 minutes after the hour. So 10 minutes. Go to email us at talk@WPR.org or phone 1-800-642-1234 to win a pair of tickets to next weekend's Garden Expo. And Melinda, what are you going to be doing at Garden Expo this year?
Well, I'm very excited. This will be my second time to appear there, so I'm very excited. It's a wonderful show. So I'm going to start out the day at 9 a.m. for the early birds, and I'm going to be talking about shade gardening. So if you're looking for choices, hostas are wonderful. So if you want some companions or some different perennials, trees, or shrubs, I've got some ideas and suggestions for you. Then in the afternoon at 3:15, I'll be talking about creating a beautiful garden for birds, butterflies, and blooms. And I want to thank ATC, who's sponsoring me. They have a Grow Smart program. And so I'll be talking about good plants for under utility lines or near utility lines, as well as those for small space and large space landscapes. So I'm very excited to be back. It's a great show. You know, we were talking about cold frames and seed starting, and this is a good place to get supplies and ideas, seeds, materials, all kind, and just inspiration and a little aromatherapy.
It really is a lot of fun just to walk through. And I'm on 9:30 on Saturday. I'm just in for the 1 hour with Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. And
oh, so, excellent.
Yeah, so we'll be answering questions. And I've got, oh gosh, I don't know, I've got, Judith and I have a lot of gifts that we'll be giving away in drawings, a lot of books, gardening and otherwise, cookbooks, and that's some really cool prizes that we'll be giving out during that hour. So that's 9:30 to 10:30 on Saturday morning, and looking forward to that as well.
So they'll have to start with me, run over and win their prize, get their questions answered, and then
back
the
to
facility.
You.
Exactly. And I wanted to also mention, if you want to start out your weekend a little early, or if you're in the Milwaukee area, I'll be at the NARI Home Improvement Show at the State Fairgrounds on Thursday at 1 and Friday at 5:30, talking about flavorful landscapes, ways to include edibles, whether it's in containers or substitute ornamentals for animal edibles or mix them all together. So if you're in southeast Wisconsin, I hope you'll join me Thursday and Friday. It'll be a nice warm-up for the weekend over in Madison.
Yeah, and that NARI show is really a good show. So
it is. Again, some landscapes, if you're looking for home improvement inside or out, great ideas as well. I think we're all, you know, this time of year we're all antsy, and it's time to start planning.
So. Eager to get out there.
Yes.
Eager to do a little planning. Well,
exactly.
Jackie in Milwaukee, speaking of Milwaukee, has something. Jackie, hi. Thank you for calling.
I would call myself a renegade gardener. I have all the books. I read all the good things, but I try things myself. I bought 3 of what they would call Christmas cactus in about November. They had no blossoms. And I put them on my kitchen table near an east window. And I watered them because I wasn't going to go downstairs. I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I watered them with the water from the tea kettle. They are on their second term of blossoming. I tried, and I read Melissa's article in the journal this past week, and it's wonderful. But what could be going on that they are blossoming?
You know,
there are
a couple,
3 of them.
Yeah.
You know, great question. Now, Christmas cactus and poinsettias, I had a professor in school as an undergrad that said, well, you know, we can write all this, we can talk about it, we can research it, but the plants don't read the book. So there's always those plants that don't do what you think they're going to do. You follow the rules, it doesn't work. You break all the rules, it does. Christmas cactus, running them in cooler temperatures and a bit drier, usually stimulates bloom. I have some in my workshop area that get good bright light, but they're a little bit of benign neglect because they're in another building, and so they run a little dry, and they probably bloom for me about 3 times a year. The other thing that we found, too, is that giving them 14 hours of total darkness, so normal daylight during the winter, will also help them form blossoms. The water from your tea's got a little bit of nutrient in there, but not enough to interfere with bloom. So it's kind of like doing a very dilute solution of fertilizer. So, you know, I think you found the right spot, the right watering technique, and the right light, which, Jackie, as a renegade gardener, you know that sometimes it's just that whole mix of everything working in favor and finding that right spot. So congratulations. Enjoy it. I had a
beautiful
like that. And what a great way to brighten up February.
Oh, absolutely.
Isn't it? Thank you, dear.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, it's a wonderful. And they really are pretty when they flower.
They certainly are. And, you know, there's a lot of gardeners I've met where they have the family Christmas cactus that's been passed down for decades.
Yeah.
A little bit of stress there to keep it alive when you've inherited it, but really wonderful decades of enjoyment from those plants.
Let's turn to Jean in Waukesha next. Jean, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I have a comment and a question. My idea for a cold frame type thing is a rack on wheels. I think we picked it up at Sam's Club or something, but it's got really good wheels that can roll right out of the garage. You get a mattress bag, big piece of plastic, put that over the whole thing, and you can put your flats in there for starting things or getting plants you've had in the house, you know, and come back and put them out. Yeah, so, you know, and then if it's cool at night, you just roll it right back in the garage, you know, and then you can lift it up plastic to let, you know, the heat out, and, yeah, it worked really well.
You know, you bring up a good point, making it movable. I met a wonderful woman in, I think it was Waterford or Edgerton, or actually Janesville, who had an old truck, and she'd harden off all her plants. She'd put all the flats in the back of her truck, and she'd bring them out in the shade the first day, a little more sun the next day, a little more sun, so she could move it around on her property. It was that big. Move it in the garage, so you'd have to clean out the garage in my case, and then back out the next day. But a wheel, your invention, what a great idea. If you make it easy to move it in and out, it gives you a lot more opportunity. So great idea. Thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, the other thing, if I can ask a quick question.
Sure, go ahead.
I still have a concern about malorganite. I've been told, yeah, it's safe, but, you know, everything goes down that drain, you know, like factories and chemicals and I don't know what. I mean, is that truly safe, whatever treatment they do to...
Yeah.
I would never use it in a vegetable garden, but I just don't really trust it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I understand, you know, one of the cool things I always tell people about gardening is you get to choose. You know,
yep.
You get to control the inputs. I'm a huge fan of malorganite, and I use it on everything, including edibles. I've been through their lab and their facility. They test daily and weekly. They exceed the EPA standards. One of the things that to also keep in mind is many natural and organic products are not tested and manures are not tested. So you always want to just make sure that whatever you're buying is what they're selling you. You know, if it's OMRI certified, that's very different. So if you're concerned about things being organic, you want to make sure you check for that OMRI certification. I feel very confident in terms of the testing process. What they do is kiln dry it, so it's pathogen-free. It's exported into Canada, so it has to go through some additional testing to be able to be exported. So the solids are taken out. The microorganisms, what malorganite is, are the microorganisms that have fed on the solids. Then they kiln dry it, and then they pelletize it, and that's what's in the bags. But, you know, again, I'm good with it, but that's my garden, and I feel confident because I've worked with the folks and seen what they do. But, you know, we all have to make those choices, and I just want to make sure you're informed. So if you're looking at various products, make sure if they're telling you it's a manure, is it pharmaceutical-free? Is it how have those cattle been raised? If they say it's organic, it should be OMRI certified. So just make sure you're, you know, getting the information you need to accomplish your goals. And I think that's the wise thing. And the best part about gardening is you do control the input. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it and appreciate you expressing your concern.
Yeah.
It's the chemicals. It's not the pathogens I'm worried about. It's chemicals.
Yeah.
Industrial chemicals and lead and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, they test for heavy metals. They test for heavy metals, and they're way below what's in commercial fertilizers. They do test. They voluntarily took it off the market 30 years ago because of a cadmium plant. So they test for heavy metals. That's one of the tests they do on I don't know if that one's the daily or the weekly basis, but they are testing for heavy metals. So. Yeah, so you might want to visit their website. There's a lot of good information on what they're doing there, malorganite.org, I think it is.
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, thanks. So, no, so they are testing. So good questions. It's always good to be an informed consumer.
And our contest is now over, so...
Okay.
Judith has been furiously answering phone calls, and she's of course also has the emails to contend with. So she's putting it all together, and there's a way that we can do this randomly, and she will be letting us know, and I'll have the names shortly for you. But no need to call anymore.
Give Judith a break.
Give Judith a break. And then also allow us to have some people actually on the air to ask questions, too. So we had, there was a question from Fred, and I think this is worth talking about for a minute. We have pet rabbits, Fred says, and we have sawdust bedding. Would it be okay to put this in the vegetable garden? And I would say no, not just fresh.
Right. One of the things with fresh manures also is that the hot spots they create. Typically, poultry, rabbit manure, because they're not meat eaters, you want to make sure that animals are free of diseases. You know, you might want to compost it first before putting it in. Check with your vet. Cat feces, urban bird feces, dog feces can carry diseases.
Yeah.
And so that's why we never recommend using those, even in your compost pile. It's better to get rid of them. So you just may want to double check with your vet. I have not heard of any problems disease-wise as long as they're healthy animals, but I'm with you. I'd compost it first.
And sawdust, I would...
thank you.
You definitely would be composting that before you ever put it in the soil, I would think.
I kind of overlooked that. I was so focused on the manure. Thank you. So the problem with sawdust, wood chips, things like that, when we work them into the garden soil, the microorganisms that break them down temporarily tie up the nitrogen in the soil, so you get yellowing of your especially annual flowers and vegetables. So Larry's right. Compost that first, and then when it's composted, then add it to your garden. You'll have much better success, and you won't have to compensate with extra fertilizer.
We had an email from Kathy in Columbus, and voles and meadow mice, population explosion last summer, ate all of her beets and potatoes and sweet potatoes and made a dent in the carrots and the eggplant and the peppers.
Oh, man.
So what are your strategies for coping? And she's, by the way, looking forward to next weekend's Garden Expo.
Me too. A couple things. Voles, often in the summer, they're finding enough food outside the garden, but it sounds like they found a great dining spot, unfortunately, in your garden. To keep them out, you'd have to put a fence at least 4 to 6 feet deep around your garden. A rat trap, if you don't mind, baited with peanut butter and oats, but put it in PVC pipe or undercover so songbirds don't get in there and trapped as well. And you may be taking out quite a few, but that might be a way to keep the population down. If, you know, you fence it first, sink your fencing, you know, preferably even 12 inches deep. That's what I did around my garden. I also have ground squirrels, but usually 6 inches is enough for your voles to keep them out. And then you may want to do some trapping in case a few of them are fenced in instead of outside. There are a few organic vole. I think it's Messenger has an organic vole repellent that you might want to try as well that can be used on and near food crops. But fencing is really your best bet anytime you're working on trying to keep wildlife out. But then follow up with some trapping just in case they're trapped inside the garden.
An email from Rachel in De Pere who said, I had my first container garden last summer in my east-facing balcony, and my herbs did beautifully, but when I brought my rosemary and cilantro and basil inside, they all died. I was able to get my basil to survive by cutting it back, but now it's really leggy, foot-long brown stem before it. It was a nice green new leaves. How do I keep my potted herbs happier inside?
Rosemary is a tough one. Last year was the first year I used artificial lights. I made sure I didn't forget to water them, and I had a beautiful plant over winter. So regular watering and good sunlight, finding the right spot. Most gardeners struggle with keeping rosemary over winter, so you're in the majority. I would just keep trying, again, finding that right spot. Basil, the nice part about basil, you could take cuttings at the end of the season, buy new plants, or start from seed. Cilantro has a very short life cycle. It grows from seed, and it quickly sets flower and seed, and then you need to start over. So I would start with your cilantro, start new plants from seeds indoors. When you bring your plants inside, fresh potting mix, a nice clean container, and I would start a lot of your herbs either from fresh new transplants, cuttings, or seeds in the case of cilantro.
2 weeks ago on this program, I bragged about my rosemary that I have indoors.
Okay.
And then I must have forgotten, and it's been going for 2 years.
Okay.
I must have missed a water. Because I hadn't looked at it for a week, you know, so it must have been 2 weeks between waterings, and that was the end of the rosemary.
You know, mine always would get through till about now, maybe March in a good year, and die. And what I told people, though, is you put it in the back of your collection, it still smells good. So
well, yeah, it's still sitting there, but Limey, my lime tree, has lost its companion.
Its
next door companion, Rosemary. Gosh. And I thought, oh, it's what you get for bragging on the air.
I know. You wait until you're sure it's past the season, right?
Oh, man. Well, we have an email from Greg to ask about, let's see, never had a garden before, but really thinking about straw bales this year. When should I get bales and prepare them? What are some good plants for a beginner? I'm thinking 4 or 5 bales. Love the show. And by the way, Joel Karsten is going to be on to talk about straw bales on February 20th. So that edition of Garden Talk. But you've used straw bales, and I have. What do you think?
Well, here's the key. And Joel is he's got a great book that takes you step by step through the process. So it takes about a month to condition, if I'm remembering right, to condition the bales. And you want to take the time and do the conditioning right, because that's setting up
your... That's the big thing.
It is. And the other thing you want to do is make sure you have a good water source nearby. Either, you know, in his book, he recommends hooking up a drip irrigation, or if you're doing 1 or 2 bales and you've got a hose nearby, you'll be great. I have to confess, I know Larry is a successful straw bale gardener. I was doing that as one of my gardening techniques out in my large garden area, and I had raised beds and lasagna gardening and in-ground gardens and this Ray Greiten technique, and I had all these things going, and I had containers close to my house in the water source. The straw bales didn't get waters as much as they should have, so shame on me. This is, again, learning from your failures. And then I think tomatoes, I know you've had great harvests from tomatoes.
Great harvest.
You can grow anything, actually. So I think when I look at starting a garden as a new gardener, what do you like to eat? What do you like to harvest fresh? Tomatoes are excellent. Where do you get your biggest value? One plant, a lot of fruit produced. You know, corn is great, not in straw bales, but corn is great, but you could do it in straw bales. But the problem is you need a lot of space to get corn, so go to the farmer's market and buy it. And Larry, do you have any favorites that you think are a must for straw bale gardening?
I just have had such good luck with all kinds of tomatoes, and I've got the little patio tomatoes. I've got that bale right next to the door where you come in from the garage.
Oh, so you think about it every day?
And you grab some. You grab some.
Oh, that sounds great.
So, oh my goodness, we're almost out of time. Melinda, thank you so much, but I want to hear are the winners. Harriet P. in Muscadet, Patrick S. in Sun Prairie, Lori D. in Superior, Mary Lee B., Judy W., Renee C., Cynthia L., who says she's Audrey, a starving student, Audrey H., Randy S. in Spring Green, and Laura H. in Grand Marsh. Though we got them all in. And thank you again for being with us. Melinda, thank you so much. And thanks for listening. Oh, my goodness. Lots more in store here. Please stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.